From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we speak with the director of the Netflix documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson. Then we learn about the new affordable housing projects that could transform some of Milwaukee's North Side neighborhoods.
Those units get leased up just like that. I mean, you get them under construction and people are lining up to reserve them. So there'll always be a demand for affordable housing. And typically, restaurants and stores want to be near where people live.
Bubbler Talk looks at Jeffrey Dahmer's impact on the gay community. Plus, we talk about the new Jon Stewart film, Irresistible, a political satire set in small-town Wisconsin.
Maybe the challenge to satirists of all kinds in 2020 is that the world itself has become so absurd that it's really hard to almost to make fun of it, because it already is sadly funny.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As many of you may know, June is Pride Month in honor of the Stonewall Uprising of 1969 in New York's Greenwich Village. Recently, demonstrations for the Black Lives Matter movement and Pride have converged, a move that harkens back to Pride's roots as a movement against police brutality and oppression, led by LGBTQ people of color. One of those leaders was Marsha P. Johnson, a gay liberation activist and self-identified drag queen who was keenly aware of the violence and abuse her community was facing. In 1992, her body was found in the Hudson River, and her suspicious death still has people asking questions today. In the 2017 Netflix documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, director David France follows activist Victoria Cruz as she tries to find out what exactly led to the death of her friend Marsha. To learn more about the documentary, I spoke with France via Zoom from his home in New York City. David France, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking a few moments to speak with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, dives into the unresolved death of Marsha. But first, I want to concentrate on her life. So who was Marsha?
Marsha was this extremely well-known and beloved figure in New York. She was an early organizer in the community in the 60s. She was considered herself a drag queen, to use the vernacular of the day. And she was kind of a mother to many other young trans people in the city. And she was turned out to be an instrumental figure at the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. Some have credited her with touching off the rebellion, but what's more true is that when she arrived after the conflagration had already began, she led a fierce flank of people into the fray and is known as one of the frontline battlers that night. But also, after that, she and her comrade Sylvia Rivera joined about a dozen other people to begin building the foundations for the modern LGBT movement that took hold after those riots. And so she's really an architect of so much of what the movement has attained over all these years. And then she and Sylvia also started the world's first transgender organization. They had conceived for the first time ever of transgender people having their own kind of social, cultural, and political needs and concerns and affinities. And in that way, she was a true revolutionary.
Yeah, the organization you refer to is the STAR organization, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. And I think it's such a true example of grassroots ingenuity, personal, not just accountability, but motivation and drive. And many people today, you know, within these past few years are becoming more aware of transgender issues. But as you say, with Marsha's example, she was the Rosa Parks of the LGBT movement. And this documentary really shows how longstanding a lot of these issues have been for the transgender community.
Absolutely. If it weren't for her, this whole conversation about gender and gender identity may have been delayed for many years. And it's really apt and appropriate that we're speaking about her and Sylvia Rivera today, the day that the Supreme Court just issued one of the most significant rulings in recent years, in which they make it federal law. It is now illegal to fire people for their transgender identity, as well as to fire gay people and lesbians simultaneously. But it's really a major, major victory at the Supreme Court. And it would be tremendous if both of those historical figures were alive today to see the outcome of the revolution that they started.
Most definitely. So obviously, Marsha holds great significance for the LGBTQ plus community. But what drew you to her story to make this documentary? This documentary more so focuses on the unsolved death of Marsha in 1992.
Well, I should start by saying that I knew Marsha, but she was kind of a mother figure to the community back in the early days. I moved to New York in the early 80s, and she was one of the first people I was introduced to in the city. It was like, if you wanted to feel like New York was your home as a young gay or lesbian person, you really needed Marsha's blessing in a way. Once we became friends, she was a daily fixture on Christopher Street, which was then the kind of mountaintop of queer life in New York. And then she would call your name day or night and wish you a happy evening. And that made you feel like you had arrived. She really expanded the community by throwing her arms open and bringing people in and making them feel at home. When she died in 92, I remember where I was when I got the news. And I was working at the time at the Village Voice, an alternative newspaper in New York. And I drew the assignment to investigate what might have happened to her. The circumstances were murky, mysterious. The police were very obviously unwilling to investigate. And so I began for a while doing my own investigation into the events of that night in 1992. But for a number of reasons, the principal one being that 1992 was a terrible year for taking a turn in the AIDS epidemic. And my partner at the time grew very sick. I abandoned the story, and my partner died in the winter of that year. And by that time, it was 6 months past her death, and I just never returned to the investigation. And I always felt that it was unfinished business, and that I really owed Marsha's memory the attention that I should be giving to this investigation around her passing. In serious ways, the memory of Marsha had faded, as had the memory of Sylvia, from the kind of the oral histories that we've been passing down to one another in the community. And I wanted to elevate both her life and try and bring justice to her surrounding the matter of her death. But the timing for this was the massive increase in violence against the transgender community over the last decade. Especially transgender women of color. And I thought if Marsha's case can go unresolved and unremembered, then what hope did any of these newer and younger victims have of finding justice in their case? So I thought it'd be very symbolic to go back to that time in 1992 and see what sense could be made of.
Throughout the documentary, you go through archival pieces and interviews you collected. And as you mentioned, no police, no city resources dedicated their time to finding out exactly what happened to resolve Marsha's death. And you highlight kind of the picking up of the baton through Victoria Cruz to be our guide through this story. So why was she an effective way to frame the documentary?
Well, Victoria Cruz is, first of all, a major historical figure of her own, was also there on that fateful June night in 1969. And she had devoted her life and her life's work to responding to violence and other crimes against the LGBT community. And as a contemporary of Marsha's, she was one of the people that I first talked to. And she felt that it was at the end of her career, she was about to retire, that she thought that this could be her swan song, that it was something that she could do and something she was driven to do, something she had the skills to do, and she was keen to let me join her in that journey. And she's a tireless investigator and a charming figure. So she really helped bring that story and that time in New York City to life in a way that is so vibrant and human.
During the Stonewall era, you mentioned Sylvia, who claimed the street people and the drag queens were the vanguards of the movement. But as you mentioned, the Pride movement seemed to grow out of touch with this, and only recently are people reacquainting themselves with people such as Marsha. And Sylvia stated in a speech she made at the 1973 Pride that she felt betrayed by the Pride movement, where it was going, that they forgot about people like her and Marsha. How do you see the modern Pride movement relearning this history and also remembering its roots in activism and the trans women who led it?
Well, you're right about that terrible turn in the early years of the movement. Star was one of the four or five major components of the early movement. And in 1973, just 4 years in, they were evicted from the movement. They were thrown out of the umbrella organization Gay Activist Alliance, and they were forsaken by the movement that they had helped start. It was a very cruel moment in the history of the movement, one that has not been adequately addressed, I don't think. But that speech that she gives in 1973 is a heartbreaking speech. She had to fight her way onto the stage to defend the role of trans women and street people, as she called them, the marginalized corners of our community, defend their right to be there and to do that work and to be recognized for the work that they had already accomplished. And it did no good. She was booed off the stage and she left the movement for many, came back to the movement after Marsha's untimely death. Marsha was found floating in the Hudson River, and that brought Sylvia back as a kind of a public person, as an activist. But by 1992, the movement in New York had become very kind of commercial. What had been called the Gay Pride March was suddenly being called the Gay Pride Parade, with floats sponsored by credit card companies and local businesses and international businesses. And the tenor changed really dramatically. And that has been a really unfortunate fact about Pride, that Pride has become a kind of a commercial marketing idea. In the recent years, in New York City and in other cities as well, there have been kind of breakaway groups that call themselves Reclaim Pride, who bring back the idea that, as they say, Stonewall was a riot, and they have organized contingents or counter demonstrations to coincide with Gay Pride Day. The Reclaim Pride people have said, inspired by the movement for Black Lives that has really energized so many people throughout the country and even throughout the world, that they are mounting a demonstration on Pride Day this year in New York in defense of Black and brown lives, in defense of transgender people of color in the community, and against the police violence and police militarization that has been the calling cry now of this new movement as it's swelling in the country.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the Black Lives Matter movement is getting some new, you know, not just allyship, but that Pride organizations around the U.S. are realizing we need to get back to this activism and roots and the issues of police brutality against the LGBTQ plus community have been longstanding. It's something Marsha and Sylvia were fighting against and what Stonewall was about. And now there's the influx of including Black trans lives, particularly Black women who are trans, and the violence that has always been against them. And while Marsha's case has been cold, like many transgender cases, most recently there were also two deaths just last week of Rhea Milton and Dominique Fells. So do you believe that there's been any like true significance progress when it comes to bringing visibility to trans lives and the violence against trans women of color especially?
Unfortunately, it's really unfinished business. You know, of all of the archival materials that I found while making the film about Marcia, the most surprising to me and important, I think, was an audio taped interview that Marcia had organized in 1992 of the transgender women who were working in the sex trade along the side of the Hudson River that summer. And they were all being physically tormented by the police. And she had taken it upon herself to call in the media to bring to light the violent treatment that was being handed down by the local police precinct. That, coupled with some other evidence that Victoria Cruz pulls together in the course of the film, leads you to believe that the most likely understanding of what happened to her on the night that she fell into the river was that she was put there or chased there by the police themselves. So this idea of police violence going unanswered has a long history, including especially within the queer community, but the community of color across the board.
You end the documentary with Victoria packing up all of her notes on the Marcia case to hopefully be looked into by someone at the FBI. But there's still no concrete answer, and that was definitely a powerful way to end the documentary. How do you hope this impacts viewers? Because it shows there's no, quote, happy ending after watching this.
Well, the work is still not finished. And I think that we took it as far as we could with the current policies and leadership in the New York City Police Department. And I am really heartened by the progress that's already been made in this short several weeks since the murder of George Floyd across the country. But in New York State, finally, they repealed a law that made it illegal to get any information on allegations of misconduct against police. Now, with that possibility now available to us, I think we're going to finally be able to get into those police files and find out what exactly was going on in that police precinct where Marcia's life had been so endangered, but also across the city and state to find out what the secrets that the police have been keeping from the community and from the people they were meant to serve over all these years, and what stories that they reveal.
People are starting to get to know Marcia again. A whole new generation is learning who she was, especially as the Black Lives Matter marches coincide with Pride and harkening back to its activist roots. How does it make you feel that Marcia is once again at the forefront of Pride?
Well, I think certainly that that's where Marcia belongs and Sylvia belongs. And for the whatever small role I played in it, I'm really pleased to think that people now who never met her, who are born generations after her, now know about Marcia, know about her significant contributions. You know, as a political strategist, she had a very unique approach to creating change, and she did it through joy and glee, really, as her kind of political sword and shield. And as we move forward now in this new thrust in our efforts to defend social justice, I hope that we can learn from those tools of hers to help us as we move forward. And she's such a transformative figure that I believe that we all need to know about her. And I think she's really one of those canonical political forces that should be in all history books.
Well, your documentary certainly helps in that effort. And David France, I want to thank you for your time today to speak about it.
Thank you, Audrey.
David France is the director of the Netflix documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, streaming now. Coming up next, Bubbler Talk looks at the impact Jeffrey Dahmer had on the gay community here in Milwaukee. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer rose to infamy after human remains were found dismembered and preserved in his Milwaukee apartment. He murdered at least 16 people in the city. 14 of them were people of color, and many of them had been part of the city's gay community. A Bubbler Talk listener wanted to know how much harm Jeffrey Dahmer's crimes caused Milwaukee's LGBT community. But to understand Dahmer's impact, we first need to look at what life was like for gay Milwaukeeans in the 1980s.
You essentially have a community that grew up being told that they really had no right to exist. You had a community of people who really only knew each other out of a sense of shame, out of a sense of disenfranchisement.
Michael Takash is the curator of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, and he describes an underground community where people used nicknames to obscure their identity. They met at bars in a dark industrial neighborhood surrounded by partially empty factories and warehouses. People were also pretty transient.
You would see somebody and they would be around all the time and then they would just be gone and you would really, you know, not think about it or not really question where they had gone.
And in 1987, when Dahmer began preying on people, it was the height of the AIDS epidemic. According to the CDC, more than 500,000 people were living with HIV by 1987 in the United States. Scott Gunkel was a bartender at Club 219, where Dahmer was a regular customer. Although he met Dahmer a few times, Gunkel found him unremarkable. What Gunkel remembers vividly is the impact of AIDS.
One year I went to 19 funerals, and it was just devastating. You know, every other week you would find somebody that passed away, and then you'd go to their funeral. I would, you know, talk to other people who knew certain people and say, hey, where's so-and-so? And they'd be like, oh, he passed away, or oh, he's sick and he's in a hospice.
In 1991, Dahmer was finally caught after one of his victims managed to escape. As the gruesome reality of his crimes became known, it was truly shocking for the community.
No one had any suspicion at the time. I mean, it wasn't as if there was, you know, this long string of disappearances and people pieced it together. There was no suspicion of anything like this happening while it was happening.
Both Takash and Gunkel say that for a short time after Dahmer's crimes were revealed, people were nervous about going out.
There was a buildup of paranoia for a while, but it really didn't last. I don't think it lasted more than a couple of months, to be honest.
And in some odd way, Dahmer's crimes led to systemic changes that helped Milwaukee's LGBT community. Although Takash is careful not to give Dahmer's crime all the credit, the nicknames did go away. People were emboldened to be open about who they were, which made them safer.
Being able to be your true self every day kind of eradicates some of these dangerous situations that people put themselves in just to find acceptance, just to find a community, and just to find a sense of caring and love.
Others like Gunkel were drawn to activism. He started to lead sensitivity training for the Milwaukee Police Department.
Activists got more engaged with the police department. Activists got more engaged with the African-American community. Communities were willing to reach out to each other.
There's no doubt that for some outsiders, Dahmer's gruesome crimes became the defining symbol of Milwaukee's gay community. But for the people who made that community, it was just another part of a long history of abuse. And they weren't about to let these monstrous acts define them.
The resilience of the gay and lesbian community in Milwaukee cannot be overstated. And Jeffrey Dahmer was kind of a fly on the windshield.
Milwaukee's LGBTQ community has come a long way since the 1980s. But that resilience, that's what brought them here. Not Dahmer. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Sun Badger Solar. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
After the break, we learn about a renewed effort to build affordable housing right here in Milwaukee. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Despite the pandemic, construction has continued on new projects in the Milwaukee area. Although many of us are more focused on this health crisis, social unrest, and economic turmoil, we're still experiencing a shortage of affordable housing. That shortage, mixed with the financial burden of housing, adds even more stress to these issues. Here in Milwaukee, there has been a renewed interest in building affordable housing, including a large project coming to the city's north side. Tom Dakin is a reporter who covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins Lake Fexjoy Powers to talk about that project, along with other projects in Milwaukee's Northside neighborhoods.
Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So there's a pretty big project that's happening on Milwaukee's north side that could have a very big impact on the city. Tell us a bit about it.
Yes, it's called the Community Within the Corridor. It's a mix of both affordable apartments, around 200 units of affordable apartments, as well as commercial space and community space, some facilities that would be open to people in the neighborhood to use, as well as serving as a amenity space like a fitness center for the residents of the apartments. And it's being developed in one of the more impoverished neighborhoods on the city's north side. This is in the 30th Street Industrial Corridor, which is the old urban industrial area of Milwaukee that had dozens and dozens of manufacturers throughout much of the 20th century, and it ran along the railroad tracks, which went, not surprisingly, along 30th Street from approximately where Miller Brewing is and Harley-Davidson, all the way north up to, past Hampton Avenue. This particular location is around Center and 32nd Street.
What makes this project so significant for that area, looking at things beyond just the sheer size of this project?
Yes, well, I mean, it is a large project, and it's a $59 million investment that, in a neighborhood that has not seen much real estate investment or really any kind of investment for decades. As a matter of fact, what it's seen is what we call disinvestment, when companies pull out and jobs disappear, and then, well, not surprisingly, we get crime and an increase in drug and alcohol addiction and all the other social ills that accompany situations like that. So it came about because a young African-American developer, Q. Elamine, he has a company called Scott Crawford Incorporated, which is named for his grandparents. Q. Elamine, he wanted to take these buildings and turn them into affordable housing with the use of federal tax credits for that purpose. These buildings also date back to the early 1900s, so they qualify for historic preservation tax credits. Those two types of tax credits, by the way, approximately account for about $37 million of the $59 million cost. The problem is he's just starting out in the development world, and by himself, he did not have the financial capability and the depth of experience and the track record to be able to go to a bank and get a loan and to get equity investors to help complete that financing package. So he approached local development companies here in the Milwaukee area, as well as I think at least one, maybe more than one in Northern Illinois, and was turned down. As he told me in the story I wrote for the Journal Sentinel and JS Online, he wasn't really surprised by that. I mean, disappointed, but not surprised given the location. Fortunately, an architectural firm, Continuum Architects, that he was working with, had worked with on another site, they knew about a development company out of Minneapolis called Roars Companies, led by a man named Brian Roars, because Continuum was doing work for a project they were doing, a market rate apartment project down in Walker's Point, where they were converting an old industrial building to high-end apartments. And Continuum introduced Brian Roars to Q. Elamine, and Brian Roars decided this was an investment that he wanted to get involved in. And what was interesting was, from Q's perspective, that was because Brian was from out of town and didn't really come into the situation with any preconceived notions about that location beyond what you would look at on black and white in terms of developer. In other words, the demographics of the area, incomes, how many people live in the area, what are the odds of attracting people to rent affordable housing there, etc. And as a result of Roars getting involved, and as a result of Q working very persistently to obtain those tax credits, as well as Continuum helping to maintain the historic preservation tax credits, that's kind of a niche of that architectural firm. This is all now coming together. They've gotten a commitment for a bank loan to fill in much of the private financing gap, And right now, as we speak, they are going through the Common Council review and they hope approval process for about $3 million in city funding that would come in the form of a tax incremental financing district. And your listeners are probably familiar with TIF districts. Basically, that money will come from the new property tax revenue generated by this development.
Yeah. You know, as you mentioned, development on Milwaukee's north side has been stunted for a long time. It hasn't grown in the same way it has in other parts of the city. But in the last couple years, it seems like we've seen more and more projects that are showing up in these neighborhoods. Can you talk about a few of those?
Oh, sure. First of all, let's talk about one that has not really launched yet, one I'm sure most listeners are familiar with, and that's Century City. That's the business park that's replacing the former A.O. Smith / Tower Automotive manufacturing complex at approximately Capitol Drive and in Hopkins, roughly. You might recall Strauss out of Franklin was going to move their slaughterhouse and meat processing operation there. That was going to take up most of that. That got defeated after some of the neighborhood residents objected. There are a couple of industries that are active there. Telgo, which makes passenger rail cars, leases space in one of the few buildings kept from the old A.O. Smith days, and then Good City Brewing leases space in a new building that was built there. So that still needs to truly launch and get going, and it's been hurt in part because at that location, when you're trying to attract industries and distribution centers, they usually like to be a little bit closer to the interstate system, and that's a little bit of a drive from I-43. But then let's talk about some areas that have been more successful, and one that I continually talk about that I think a lot of people just aren't aware of because it's, for let's be blunt, for a lot of white people, it's out of sight, it's out of mind, but that's the Harambee neighborhood. And that's the neighborhood that extends north of downtown from roughly North Avenue going all the way north up to near Capitol Drive, kind of along Martin Luther King Drive is sort of the main north-south route. And we've seen over the years, and especially in recent years, affordable housing developed in that neighborhood, again, driven in part by tax credits. We've seen also, though, some various commercial developments, restaurants and other businesses coming into that area. And right now there's a big project pending just south of North Avenue, which is in the Harambee area, and also the Hellyer Park neighborhood. And that's the conversion of the former Schuster's department store, one of the grand old department stores from Milwaukee's past that ceased to be a department store by approximately the early 70s. And it's being converted into offices for the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Medical College of Wisconsin, and then some affordable housing. And Royal Capital Group is taking the lead on that. And that's another development firm run by a younger African-American man.
Well, like that project, some of these developments are really still in the works. And this is something we talked about a bit before this conversation, but there are a lot of protests that are going on and a lot of unrest in neighborhoods throughout the city, throughout the Milwaukee area, but specifically in Milwaukee's North Side neighborhoods. Is that a threat to development? Do developers see these kinds of social movements and say, well, maybe let's hold off on building there?
Well, when I did the story on Community Within the Corridor, the folks from Roar's company said, no, we're not tapping the brakes. We're going forward. And as I mentioned earlier, they are right now in real time proceeding to get city approval for one of the last chunks of the financing package, that TIF district. So it hasn't stymied that. In the Harambee neighborhood, when you talk about quote unquote unrest, we should probably differentiate here between peaceful protests, which has been the majority of the activity, people exercising their constitutional rights, their civil liberties to make their feelings known. Let's separate that from the incidents of crime, people vandalizing buildings, people breaking into buildings and stealing things. That was really confined to roughly that first weekend after the killing of George Floyd up in Minneapolis. And some of that did happen in the Harambee neighborhood, specifically right around the intersection of Locust and King Drive, where there's a district Milwaukee Police Department station. And I did a separate story in the aftermath of that and talked to people who work there and have property there. And I think the prevailing view is that it might slow down development, but it's not going to stop development. And I think it was summed up best by a gentleman named Randy Crump, who has been active in construction development for decades. And he said, there's still opportunities here for people who aren't afraid of Black people. If you're a developer and if you don't have an inordinate fear of Black people and you don't have an inordinate fear of neighborhoods that are mostly African American, look at the demographics here, look at the income characteristics, the availability of workforce, the proximity downtown, the availability of mass transit, you're going to see the benefits of coming here. By the way, incidentally, Mr. Crump, Randy Crump, he runs a company called Prism Technical Services, and they're a firm that's hired by developers and general contractors to consult with on obtaining hiring disadvantaged businesses and disadvantaged workers for different projects. And he also, incidentally, is the father of Lafayette Crump, who's been nominated to be the next city development commissioner, awaiting confirmation from the Common Council on that.
Hmm. So recognizing this is a fairly loaded question because we're in the middle of an economic downturn and we're in the middle of a pandemic, which has made a lot of kind of future planning difficult. What does the forecast look like for Milwaukee's Northside neighborhoods?
Well, given that some of these projects we've just been talking about, Community Within the Corridor being one of them, some of the other ones that have an affordable housing element, I think actually the forecast is pretty good because affordable housing is one of the main components in many of these developments. And with affordable housing, it's usually just a matter of competing to obtain the tax credits from the federal and, in some cases, state governments. The typical history of developing affordable housing in Milwaukee and many other cities is those units get leased up just like that. I mean, you get them under construction and people are lining up to reserve them. So there'll always be a demand for affordable housing. And typically, restaurants and stores want to be near where people live. So when you drive population growth in a neighborhood by adding apartments, you get more demand for restaurants and supermarkets and hairstylists and, you know, you name it. That's what often drives that type of growth.
Alrighty. Well, Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me, Joy. I appreciate it.
Tom Dakin covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's a regular Lake Effect contributor. He spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find more of their conversations at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then discuss Jon Stewart's new Wisconsin-centered film, Irresistible. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Campaign finance, dark money, super PACs, political campaigning. Well, that sounds like a perfect comedy to be set in small town Wisconsin. Irresistible, written and directed by late night talk show veteran Jon Stewart, aims to be a civic lesson wrapped in realistic absurdity with a touch of Midwest nice that we're known for. The film follows Gary Zimmer, a Democratic political strategist played by Steve Carell, who uses running a mayoral campaign for a Wisconsin farmer as a way to come out of his post-2016 election slump and re-energize the heart of the Democratic Party that was long neglected. But Stewart's target is not just the Democratic Party. Actress Rose Byrne stars as Faith Brewster, the Republican National Committee closer that also descends on the small town from Washington, D.C., to ensure the Republican incumbent mayor wins the election. The dynamics between the setting of fictional Deerlock in Wisconsin and the way D.C. outsiders descend to create change, while on the surface may seem like entertainment, is not far from the truth of how America operates. To discuss more about Irresistible, I'm joined by film contributor Dave Lurson. Dave Lurson, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you. It's good to be back, even though it's virtual still at this point.
Exactly. Well, this also impacted the movie we're going to talk about right now, Irresistible. It's the newest film written and directed by Jon Stewart. It was slated to open in theaters last month, but due to COVID, is going to be released on demand on the 26th of this month. So how about we just set the scene for our listeners about this new political comedy from Stewart?
Well, yes, political comedy is the word here. It, I say it pokes fun of both parties, certainly, but the primary objective of this film is the Democratic Party's loss of connection with blue-collar voters, the loss of connection that many activists within the Democratic Party have worried about, that loss of the heartland. Of all those people who routinely are denounced for voting against their own best interests and supporting the rightward drift that led to the rise of Donald Trump. There was a book out either earlier this year or late last year by the Nebraska or Kansas Democratic Party chairwoman describing how the Democratic Party can find, you know, common ground pretty easily, really, with a rural constituency. One of my favorite political writers, Thomas Frank, has been on this case for several years now, talking about the Democratic Party's need to focus less on special interests and more on a broader appeal to the common good. And so Jon Stewart, I think, is taking up this position here by looking at an East Coast elite leadership of the Democratic Party that is fumbling around trying to figure out how to make these connections.
Do you think that this issue is taken up well, kind of in this little more digestible format of film with comedians and people that we know?
Well, I suppose it will appeal to more people than would read a policy-length book or watch a documentary on the failure, real, imagined, or exaggerated, of the Democratic Party in reaching rural and blue-collar voters. Because, you know, it's the value of taking a serious idea and making it entertaining, adding a little bit of humor. It's an age-old way of getting a message across.
Right, and I kind of enjoy how it plays off that news has essentially become entertainment, so why not make it even more entertaining and educational and put it in a movie?
Yeah, certainly nothing wrong with that at all. I think the peculiar thing about the release of the movie is that it comes at a time when we are all distracted by different kinds of social and political issues, and maybe if there's a downfall to Irresistible is that, you know, had it been released in March or April as originally planned, it would have seemed very timely. And now, I mean, it doesn't really have a whole lot to say about Black Lives Matter, but, certainly not COVID-19 and the response to the pandemic. So it seems like it's a little, you know, late to arrive. It's not quite timely in the way that Jon Stewart may have hoped it would be.
Right. So obviously the world of film and pre-production cannot timely respond to current events, as you said. But do you think that the film was maybe too broad? What did you think of the overall feel of the film? You know, it starts off setting the scene. Steve Carell's character, Gary, is a top Democratic strategist, and it shows the aftermath of Hillary losing the election. And of course, Wisconsin was a big noted news event that Wisconsin wasn't won.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that Irresistible reflects the frustration that many Democrats and people of progressive political bent felt toward the way the Hillary campaign was run, the way that the Hillary campaign did seem to ignore some obvious sectors of the United States. I mean, she didn't visit Wisconsin during the campaign, and it became a sore point for a lot of people. This film is definitely amplifying this frustration and putting it into a comical light.
What was your opinion on how the film wanted to capture small town Wisconsin in the heartland of America? Of course, you have rallies that include a fish fry and a polka, but did you think they worked well and had some Wisconsin consultants, or what did you think of, you know, basically their interpretation of our state?
Well, yeah, I had read very little about the movie in advance, and the information I had was kind of sketchy, so I was taken by surprise that the beloved fictional town of Deerhawken, Wisconsin, was the setting for this. In the aftermath, I found out more that it was actually filmed in Georgia. So is Georgia a good stand-in for Wisconsin? I mean, I guess I didn't see anything that struck me as being really out of place. There were no palm trees in the background, no mountain ranges that don't exist in Wisconsin. I think it was okay. I think where it excelled was getting at the sort of Wisconsin upper Midwest sensibility that maybe we take for granted here, the kind of easygoing, have a good one, temperament of the average person interacting with each other, which seems very strange to the Steve Carell character. I mean, he feels like he's landed on a different planet where, you know, people talk this way and offer you, you know, free bakery from the oven and this kind of thing. I think that there certainly is a lot of truth to that in the way that Midwesterners are compared to some other regions of the U.S.
Right, that Midwest nice is contrasted so plainly with Steve Carell's character, his strategist Gary. And then when he gets involved in highlighting the character known as the Colonel, played by Chris Cooper, in running a campaign for mayor, he gains the attention of Rose Byrne's character, Faith, who is basically the Republican strategist nemesis. So what did you think of the two of their performances? Because clearly these are D.C. outsiders coming to a small Wisconsin town, so the character interplay is very prevalent in this movie.
Yeah, they both come armed with a great deal of money to support two different mayoral candidates, the incumbent Republican being supported by the Rose Byrne character with lots of PAC money, and the Chris Cooper character, the dairy farmer and Marine Corps veteran that Steve Carell is getting behind. And, you know, they're both obvious outsiders, Rose Byrne and Steve Carell's characters in this town. They both manage to, gather together groups of supporters behind their particular issue. And, of course, it becomes a nationwide media spectacle, battle for the heartlands, a partisan test case. Can a Democrat, the Chris Cooper character, win in a rural constituency such as Deerhawken, Wisconsin? And so to do this, I mean, you know, the advertising campaign that Steve Carell devises is really, you know, it's frighteningly realistic. There's a TV ad for Cooper, tempered by war, driven by faith, a new kind of Democrat. It's not too much of an exaggeration from the way TV ads are, with the ominous voices and the dramatic orchestration of music and all this kind of stuff. And this becomes maybe the challenge to satirists of all kind in 2020, is that the world itself has become so absurd that it's really hard to almost to make fun of it, because it already is sadly funny. And what can you do? You can exaggerate further a little bit, but then again, you find real life examples of things that are more ridiculous than the exaggeration you are conceiving. So I take nothing away from Jon Stewart's effort here, but again, I think that people like him have a much harder time in 2020 than they would have in 1980 or 1990.
Well, that's an interesting take on it, because I was wondering before sitting down to watch it, you know, if that late night explainer approach could be transferred from the world of late night comedy into a feature film. So how did you think Stewart did in writing and directing this?
Well, I think he achieved that goal. I mean, it has that kind of sensibility, and will certainly appeal to his audience. Did he hope to reach beyond his audience with this? Are the real-life people from towns like Deerhawken going to flock to this? Would they have flocked to theaters to see this? Or are they checking it out on video on demand right now? I have a feeling that the answer is no. I think that the message of this film is really directed toward elements of the Democratic Party to energize them and make them aware of some of the deficiencies that occurred with the previous presidential campaign.
Yeah, and in the credit scene, we won't give away the twist of plot for our listeners, but of course in the credits you kind of go back to a late night example of interviewing an expert on the way the system works, how campaigns are done, super PACs, dark money, all of these things. But I also think the film did well in delivering what could have been a very complicated story about the intricacies of campaign finance in a very concise way. You know, for the first time, we were close to the traditional 90-minute film.
Yes, yes. No, I gave him a great deal of credit for being able to distill complicated, wonky, you know, kinds of things, you know, campaign finance. What does this look like today post Citizens United? How does it work? How does it not work? What is the effect of all of this? How do political consultants attempt to determine specific demographics and demographic groups of people to reach them? I think, you know, again, it's frighteningly realistic. And again, the challenge is okay, I mean, this is funny, but I mean, this is real life. I mean, it's not too far removed from the reality of the situation, if it's removed from it at all in any measurable way.
Right. The whole question of why do we accept that this is how things work, you know, and how the average person from Deerhawken, Wisconsin, does not benefit from this system.
Exactly. So it does make the point quite well. And I would have to say that for all of the spoofing of Steve Carell's character, I think that Faith Brewster, the Rose Byrne GOP strategist, comes off much worse.
Indeed. Well, overall, I did enjoy the little break, I suppose, from one news topic to another, but put in a very pleasant Wisconsin way, I suppose.
Yes. Well, and I hope it does find an audience of people. I think it deserves a good look and a couple of laughs.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you, Audrey.
Dave Lurson is the arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express and one of our regular film contributors. We talked about the new Jon Stewart film Irresistible, which is now available on demand. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR.